Last time we were talking about redox reactions, which are really important in this unit. And the examples we showed so far were ionizations. Ionizations are clearly oxidation and reduction because something gains an electron and something loses an electron. But that's not the only way that you can have a redox reaction. Slide 4 shows you an example of another way, which is a combustion reaction. A combustion reaction is a reaction of some sort of fuel with oxygen. And the fuel here, just for example, is CH4, which is methane, natural gas. If you combust methane, then what you get as products when it reacts with oxygen is carbon dioxide and water. It's an exergonic reaction. Combustion reactions are exergonic. They release energy. This is why we burn natural gas, for instance, for cooking or whatever. But it doesn't have to be methane to have these products. Any organic fuel, if you combust it, react it with oxygen, will produce the same outputs: carbon dioxide, water, and some amount of energy. And that includes when we use our fuels, which are organic fuels, in our cells. What we're doing is combustion. We just don't do it all in one step, like this shows. For instance, the master fuel, the main fuel in all cells, is glucose. That's an organic fuel, and when you combust it, you get carbon dioxide and water. Okay, that'll become more clear as we get into the particulars of glucose catabolism, but the point here, and as far as redox is concerned, is that there isn't ionization happening here. No ions are formed. But it's still a redox reaction. Something gets reduced and something gets oxidized. Even though it's not a complete transfer of electrons, it's sort of a partial transfer. What I mean by that is, what qualifies it as redox is that some electrons get closer to an atomic nucleus than they were beforehand. That's why the blue dots are shown here. What makes methane and all hydrocarbons, remember methane is a hydrocarbon, nothing but carbon and hydrogen, what makes hydrocarbons in general good fuels is that they are made up, they have carbon-hydrogen bonds. And carbon-hydrogen bonds are nonpolar, right? Because carbon and hydrogen have equal electronegativities. That means their electron pairs are shared equally. Well, notice that each pair shared by a carbon and a hydrogen is appearing more or less halfway between each of the two atomic nuclei, the hydrogen nucleus and the carbon nucleus. Equal sharing. But think about the position of electrons compared to the nucleus and what that means. We talked about energy levels. The closer you get to the nucleus, the lower the energy level is, right? Well, when the fuel gets combusted, notice the pairs of electrons in the oxygen molecule are halfway between as well, because that's nonpolar. But when the reaction occurs, notice that the rearrangement of bonds means that the electrons are now closer to an atomic nucleus than they were before. They've gone down in energy level, in other words, which is why energy is released. But that also qualifies it as a redox reaction. And in any combustion of a fuel, we're looking at methane as an example, which cells don't use as a fuel, but the same will be true for glucose or any other fuel that cells use. It's always the fuel that becomes oxidized. That's why the fuel is called a reducing agent. Remember that confusing terminology that I told you about in lab. The thing that becomes oxidized is called the reducing agent because when it becomes oxidized, that causes something else to become reduced. And oxygen is always the oxidizing agent, which is called that because oxygen becomes reduced. Well, the fuel gets oxidized into carbon dioxide, and the oxygen gets reduced into water. All right? That's a redox reaction. And you can obviously do this in one step, which is what you do if you put a match to methane, for you light the stove, a gas stove. That's happening all in one shot. So all of that energy is released in one step. But remember, last time we talked about the fact that organisms don't do that. They're more like that multi-step hydroelectric system in which instead of releasing everything all at once, they do it stepwise. So we don't, even though it is a combustion reaction that's happening in our cell, or it's combustion of fuels that happens in our cells, it's not a one-step, one-reaction process. It has the same starting and the same ending point, but it takes several reactions to get to that ending point. In other words, we do it as a biochemical pathway, not as a single reaction. And that allows for much more manageable release of energy a little bit at a time so that it can be captured. Well, that brings us to slide 5, which shows you one step, one reaction. But as I mentioned last time, this is just a summary reaction. You could do this as a reaction, but this is not what cells do. This is the combustion of glucose. C6H12O6 is glucose, the master fuel. And if you all at once burn it, combust it, so that it's one step, it will release carbon dioxide and water and energy, as I said. That energy released all at once would be too much to handle for cells. So this is not what happens in cells, but it's useful to look at this because it doesn't matter how many steps you take to get from the left side to the right side. The amount of energy that's released is only determined by the starting and the ending points. So it's the same overall delta G whether you do it in one step or many steps. And once again, it's always the fuel, in this case glucose, that becomes oxidized. That's how we use our fuels. We oxidize our fuels to extract energy from them. And it's always oxygen that becomes reduced. And the way that we oxidize our fuels, remember the definition of oxidation is removal of electrons, but actually we remove more than just electrons from our fuels. We remove hydrogen atoms, which of course include electrons. So when I say that we oxidize our fuels to extract energy from them, what we really do is pick off hydrogen atoms from that fuel. And notice there's a lot of hydrogen atoms in here. This is why it's a good fuel. But think about what glucose is molecularly. It's a 6-carbon monosaccharide. So it has a carbon skeleton made out of 6 atoms, and then there's other things connected to that skeleton. If we pick off the hydrogens from that skeleton, then the only thing that's going to be left out, and we also dismantle the skeleton. So you have a 6-carbon skeleton with a bunch of hydrogens. You pick off the hydrogens and dismantle the carbon skeleton. All you have left are 6 individual carbon dioxide molecules. That's what's left over after all the usable energy that we can get at in the fuel is removed. We remove it in the form of hydrogen atoms. And those hydrogen atoms end up getting put on to oxygens to form water. All right? So the carbon dioxide that you breathe out all the time, then you need to get rid of, that's just what's left over of the food you ate originally. After it's been burned to release the energy so that we can trap some of that energy and put it to use building ATP molecules, which can then power the various things that our cells need to do. CO2 is just completely spent fuel. Think of it that way. But it starts out as glucose or some other fuel. Glucose usually is the fuel, though. All right, now to six. Well, I just got done telling you that we oxidize our fuels by picking off hydrogen atoms, and that's what's shown happening here. Notice that this is not a complete molecule that's on the left side. This is just part of a fuel. These unmet bonds, these sticks hanging off, just show you that this is only part of the overall molecule. So it's part of glucose. This is just one of the carbons of the six carbons in the carbon skeleton. All right? But you have a couple of hydrogens you can pick off of that. And that would be oxidation, because when you take those hydrogens away, you're taking electrons away. Well, if you do that, notice that what you're left with in that part of the molecule is everything except the hydrogens. So it's a carbon-oxygen bond, no hydrogens left. And it makes sense to call removal of hydrogen from something dehydrogenation. That's what dehydrogenation means, removal of hydrogen. And so that's how specifically we oxidize our fuels, by dehydrogenating them, removing hydrogen atoms from them. And as we've already talked about quite a bit, any given biochemical reaction occurring in a cell is helped by a specific kind of enzyme. And remember, enzymes are not reactants. So enzymes should never be on the left or the right of the arrow, only on top or the bottom of the arrow, to show that they are an enzyme and they're not being changed in that process. But you can also tell, besides from the fact that it's above the arrow, that that word dehydrogenase is an enzyme because it ends in ASE. Well, I told you last time that typically enzyme names are given either for the substrate that they work on, the substrate that fits into that enzyme, the reactant in other words, or they're named for what they do. In this case, this enzyme is named for what it does. It helps out the dehydrogenation of a fuel. And so it's called dehydrogenase. Now, the only thing I haven't talked about in this picture yet is this NAD player in the game. NAD, that's not a chemical formula. NAD is an acronym for nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. Let's examine these parts of the name of this thing. First of all, it is a dinucleotide. What does that tell you? Yes, it is a molecule made out of two nucleotides that are hooked together. And we'll see a picture of it in a minute. But that's why that's part of the name. If you think about... Well, I'll show you the picture in a second, then it'll make more sense. Let me finish with this slide, though, to tell you that this NAD is not only a dinucleotide, but it functions as a coenzyme. Coenzymes are molecules that carry things from one place to another in a process. And there's two major kinds of coenzymes, well, eventually three, I guess, that we're going to be talking about in this unit. NAD is the main one, but there will be some related ones later. Anyway, the things that they carry are electrons and protons. And specifically, they're carrying them from fuel, because we're picking the fuel. We're picking hydrogens off of fuel, right? But think about what one hydrogen atom is. It's an electron and a proton. So the coenzymes, including NAD, pick up these electrons and protons, and then they deliver them later on in the process. We'll worry about where they deliver them to later. But the fact that they're picking things up and dropping them off means that they operate more or less as taxis. I want you to think about them as little tiny taxis, and there's a fleet of taxis in a cell, just like there's so many taxis in a fleet in a city, right? Some of them are being used at the moment, some of them are not. So in real taxis in a real city, any given individual taxi is either being used, it's full of passengers, or it's empty. Similarly with coenzymes, and particularly nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, NAD. So since it's like a little taxi, it can exist in either of two forms, carrying passengers or not carrying passengers. But since the passengers include electrons, it's electrons and protons that are being carried, remember? Since that includes electrons, that means that when one of these little taxis is carrying electrons, it is reduced, right? Because reduction is gain of electron. If it picks up an electron passenger, that means the coenzyme becomes reduced. And therefore, the thing that it got picked up from, that the electrons got picked up from, becomes oxidized. Well, the thing that the taxis pick the electrons up from are the fuels, glucose, in the form of hydrogen. But think of a hydrogen atom that gets picked out of the fuel as being two things, a proton and an electron, rather than a single atom. All right, so once again, the fuel gets oxidized by being dehydrogenated, picked off of hydrogen atoms. Each hydrogen atom has an electron and a proton that get picked up by one of these tiny taxis, NAD. That oxidizes the fuel because the fuel is losing that electron, and it reduces the taxi. So the two forms of NAD, the two forms of the coenzyme that can exist, either full taxi or empty taxi, are reduced and oxidized coenzymes. All right? Now notice there's two NAD shown here, before and after the reaction. NAD plus first, and then NADH and H plus second. These are the two forms. Which of these two forms is the reduced form? NADH and H plus is the symbol for the reduced form because it has already picked up the hydrogen, the electron and the proton, right? Actually, two electrons and protons. NAD plus is the empty taxi. It's the oxidized form. It has not yet picked up the passengers. Now, it's also really important to make straight in your mind that the oxidized form of a coenzyme is much lower energy than the reduced form. And that's because the passengers have energy. Think of the electrons that get stripped from the fuel as having energy. Therefore, the passenger full taxi, which is the reduced form, has much higher energy than the oxidized form. All right, let's take a look now at NAD in slide 7. Make sense of the name. You were right in saying that it's a dinucleotide. Well, think about what, in general, one nucleotide has to have in it to be a nucleotide. There's three parts. Remember, a single nucleotide has a pentose sugar that is connected to two different things. On one end of the sugar, it's connected to a nitrogenous base, and on the other, it's connected to at least one phosphate, right? Well, we talked about nucleotides when we in the chapter about macromolecules. DNA and RNA are made out of nucleotides. And in that case, when you're building either an RNA molecule or a DNA molecule, there's only certain kinds of nucleotides that get used, namely the ones that have either adenine, guanine, cytosine, thymine, or uracil as the nitrogenous base. But that doesn't mean those are the only possible nitrogenous bases. That's just if you're building RNA or DNA. Here you have one nucleotide on the bottom. If this were by itself, just split it right there. This would be one nucleotide. And this nitrogenous base happens to be adenine. And this is ribose. So just adenine and ribose by itself, if that were by itself, that would be adenosine. And so this nucleotide would be adenosine monophosphate, if it were by itself, right? Up here you have a different nitrogenous, different nucleotide. It's ribose again, but now you have a nitrogenous base that's not used in DNA or RNA. This happens to be nicotinamide. That's the name of a nitrogenous base. Well, if you get both of these nucleotides together and hook them with their phosphates, then you have nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide. They're named for the two different nitrogenous bases. And it's kind of a complex molecule, but as far as being a taxi is concerned, what makes it function for this purpose is just the nicotinamide part, which is why that is in white background. The rest of the molecule in blue is there, but this is the door of the taxi, so to speak, where the passengers can enter and leave. Okay, now this happens to be on the left. Everything in the blue box is the oxidized form. What is the oxidized form? Is that full or empty taxi? That's the empty taxi. That's the low energy. It hasn't picked anything up yet. And in symbols, that's NAD+. It's plus because nicotinamide is ionized. All right, so just by before you pick up any passengers, NAD is already positively charged. It's NAD+. Now, in the previous slide, I was showing you that at one carbon at a time of the skeleton, two hydrogen atoms get picked off. Two hydrogens get dehydrogenated. Well, think about what two hydrogen atoms is in terms of subatomic particles. What do you have if you have two hydrogen atoms?
And they could like bond together, you can have a hydrogen molecule.
Well, what I mean is just think about it only as a collection of subatomic particles. If you have two hydrogen atoms, what do you have for subatomic particles? Exactly, and that's it. You have two electrons, two protons. Now, you're picking those up. One electron, just take that first, is going to turn NAD plus into NAD because the negative electron undoes the positive. That gives you, and then you still have three more passengers. Another electron plus two protons still. Okay? You take the second electron and one of the protons. That electron and proton together make up a hydrogen atom, right? So when you add that to NAD, NAD without a plus sign, that makes it NADH. But then you still have this extra proton, and it actually can't get carried by the taxi. So it's left over, which is why we write the as a symbol, the reduced form of NAD as NADH plus H plus. You still have a proton on its own that's in solution. The right side of this is the reduced form. So this is the much higher energy form. And by the way, they only drew the nicotinamide part of it. All the rest of this in blue is still here on the right side. It's just showing you that it's the actual nicotinamide nitrogenous base that is the thing becoming reduced when it picks up the passengers. And also notice the double arrows. This is a fully reversible reaction, which is just like the analogy of a taxi. A taxi doesn't keep the passengers forever when it picks it up. It drops them off somewhere, and then it can makes it back into an empty taxi, and it can pick up more passengers somewhere else. That's how these things operate. Continuously picking up energy in the form of hydrogen atoms from fuel and dropping those electrons and protons off somewhere that we'll talk about later. All right? Slide 8. Well, before we looked at methane being all at once combusted, you can also combust just pure hydrogen, which doesn't have any carbon in it at all. And it is a very good fuel, which they found out when the Hindenburg, that's what blew up the Hindenburg. They had to use hydrogen instead of helium because we had all the helium during the war. But anyway, if you use hydrogen and combust it, that has a pretty negative delta G. That's why there's such a big jump in free energy here from fuel to product. The product in this case is just water. Okay? Well, the hydrogen here is just hydrogen gas that you're putting flame to. But in cells, the hydrogen can be used as fuel since it comes from the sugar, glucose. But once again, we don't do that all in one step. Instead, we strip those hydrogens and move them along a little bit at a time to their final destination. And that involves these coenzymes that are doing the taxiing of these electrons and protons from the hydrogen. But what the electrons specifically get moved along are protein complexes within mitochondria that collectively form what are called electron transport chains. And that's where a little bit of energy at a time gets released. That's what makes it like a multi-step hydroelectric plant, specifically the electron transport chains that we'll look at in detail in a minute, or eventually, as part of this chapter. All right, so that's what the E minuses are. Those are electrons. You also have protons, and I'll explain how the protons get moved, but they don't go down the electron transport chain. They get moved separately. But then they get put back together, not necessarily the same electron with the same proton, but when you put an electron and proton back together, you form a hydrogen atom, right? And oxygen receives those. In other words, the hydrogen gets stuck onto oxygen to produce water. It's the same product as if you do it all in one shot, and it's also the same overall change in energy, but it's just released in manageable steps so that we can produce ATP from those manageable steps along the way, rather than just exploding the cell all at once and dying. Now that brings us to 9, where we can finally start talking about the overall process, given this background information which we've been talking about up till now. The overall process is what I told you should call it last time. It's more than just cellular respiration, even though that's what the name of the chapter. The overall process is the complete oxidation of glucose. And that summary reaction that I showed you a couple slides ago with the C6H12O6, that's the summary reaction for the complete oxidation of glucose. But the cell doesn't do it in one step. It does it in multiple steps. And so the overall process of the complete oxidation of glucose, it can be subdivided into 2 major parts. The first part of the complete oxidation of glucose is glycolysis, which you can see here with the teal box. Now, glyco, just like in glycosidic linkage, for instance, means sugar, which glucose is an example of. And lysis is splitting, right? So glycolysis linguistically means sugar splitting, which is a good description because that's what happens. Glycolysis is part one of the overall process, but glycolysis itself has multiple steps to it. There's 10 steps just to glycolysis. But it's the first overall part. The second part of the complete oxidation of glucose is cellular respiration. So glycolysis is not really part of cellular respiration, even though some books will lie more or less and tell you that it is. Glycolysis happens first, and then cellular respiration can happen. You also see from this slide where these two parts are happening. This yellow thing is one mitochondria. So the cell that it's part of would be bigger than this room, right? We're inside the cell. The tan background here just is outside of the mitochondria. That's still inside the cell, but it's outside of the organelle. So that's the cytosol. The cytosol is just the liquid part of the cytoplasm. It's all the stuff that's inside the cell, but outside of the organelles. And that is where glycolysis happens, out in the cytosol. Cellular respiration, and we're assuming this is a eukaryotic cell we're looking at, because they're the only ones that have these membrane-bounded organelles. But cellular respiration, which happens after glycolysis, occurs in a mitochondrion, not in the cytosol. Now, each of these two major parts is multiple steps. We'll look at the steps eventually. But for now, I want you to realize that each of these major subdivisions of the complete oxidation of glucose has inputs and outputs. Well, glycolysis, as one input, has glucose. Glucose is what's getting split. And so it's the fuel input. It's a material input. It's a molecule, in other words. It's matter. The multiple arrows show you that this is not one step. Neither is it three, though. It's actually 10 steps. But after those 10 steps are completed, one glucose molecule, which is a six-carbon sugar, so one six-carbon compound, glucose, gets split into two three-carbon compounds. Each pyruvate, which is the end product of glycolysis, each pyruvate is a three-carbon fuel. And that's why there are two of them left over, right? You don't lose or gain any carbon atoms, but you start with one six-carbon molecule and you end up with two three-carbon molecules. Plus hydrogens and oxygens connected to those skeletons. Well, glycolysis releases some energy. That shouldn't surprise you based on what I've just said. You're breaking a six-carbon compound into two three-carbon compounds, right? That's catabolic. You should expect that to be exergonic, releases energy. And it does. That's why the cells do it. But the pyruvate that gets produced as the end product is not yet completely spent fuel. It still has a carbon skeleton with hydrogens on it. In other words, what you started out with as glucose has not, by the end of glycolysis, been completely dismantled. Only when a cell is able to completely dismantle that carbon skeleton and pick off all the hydrogens is all of the usable energy that it can extract from it gotten from it. So put another way, pyruvate is still useful fuel. It's just the end of glycolysis. And therefore, only part of the usable energy has been extracted from glucose by the time glycolysis is done. So that's one input and one output of glycolysis. In order for this to happen, though, you have to pick hydrogens off, some of the hydrogens off of that glucose, like I've been talking about. And therefore, you need some taxis to pick those up, the electrons and protons from those hydrogens that get picked off. And that's why another input is, the input into glycolysis, is NAD+, empty taxis, so that they can pick up the electrons and protons in the form of hydrogen. All right? And when they pick them up, that, of course, fills the taxi. So an output is NADH and H+, the reduced form of the coenzyme. That's why this is coming out. NADH, it doesn't say NADH and H+, but the H+ is there as well, is coming out. That's a very important output, because just like pyruvate still has a bunch of usable energy in it, the NADH, the reduced coenzyme, has a bunch of energy. That's valuable stuff. You don't want to lose the taxi. All right? It's just not being put to use yet. It's carrying that energy temporarily. Well, and also an input is ADP, adenosine diphosphate, which is an energy-carrying molecule that we talked about, but it's not carrying as much energy as it could, right? If you stick another phosphate onto it, you can turn it into ATP. So ADP is one of the inputs, and it gets turned into one of the outputs, ATP. In terms of goals for this overall process, if you want to think about it in terms of goals, the goal is to produce as much ATP as possible from the energy that you can extract from the fuel, which originally is glucose. Some ATP gets produced during glycolysis, but not all that much. And therefore, if a cell is capable of only glycolysis, then it can make only a little bit of ATP, and it doesn't come close to completely spending its fuel. It's using just a little bit of that energy. That's why cellular respiration exists for certain kinds of cells. And that's why if a cell is capable of cellular respiration, it will want to not stop at pyruvate, the end of glycolysis, but then go on and keep processing that valuable fuel until it's completely spent. That's what cellular respiration is, a way to start off where glycolysis leaves off. And you can kind of see that with this middle white arrow here. Glycolysis ends at pyruvate. Pyruvate then has to go into a mitochondrion for cellular respiration to occur and process the rest of that energy that's still in that partially spent fuel, which is what pyruvate should be thought of as. All right, that's glycolysis. Cellular respiration in the overall scheme is major part two of the overall process, right? But it can then be broken down into multiple subparts itself. And specifically, there are three parts of cellular respiration. One of which is not shown here, it's not named here at least. The first part of cellular respiration is represented just by this white arrow, but it has a name. The first part of cellular respiration is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. And we'll get into the particulars of that in a separate slide. But obviously this involves pyruvate, right? It's the oxidative decarboxylation of it. Not only is it oxidatively decarboxylated, but pyruvate gets imported into the mitochondrion because the mitochondrion is where cellular respiration is occurring, including part one. So that's part one. Part two is this cycle that can go by any of three names. It can be called the citric acid cycle, as labeled here. If you want to name it after a scientist, it can be called the Krebs cycle. Or most biochemists would call it the tricarboxylic acid cycle. And that's usually abbreviated the TCA, tricarboxylic acid cycle. Doesn't matter which of those you use as long as you know that all three of them mean the same thing. The third part of cellular respiration is oxidative phosphorylation, as you see in the violet box. Well, this is part three of cellular respiration, which is already part two of the overall process. But part three of cellular respiration, oxidative phosphorylation, has two components to it. So you're subdividing it once again. And the two components of oxidative phosphorylation, as you see after the colon, are electron transport and chemiosmosis. Now, we'll look at each of these various parts individually. But while we're still on this slide, I want you to see that ATP, which is the goal, remember, is produced in three of these three parts of this overall process. I've already told you that some ATP is produced by glycolysis. Some ATP is produced in the citric acid cycle. And some is produced in oxidative phosphorylation. How that ATP gets produced is a little bit different depending on where you are. The ATP that's produced in glycolysis and the ATP that's produced in the citric acid cycle, those are produced by a method called substrate level phosphorylation, which I'll explain in a little bit. But the phrase substrate level should tell you that an enzyme is involved carrying a substrate. I mean, a substrate and an enzyme are involved. The ATP that gets produced, though, by the oxidative phosphorylation part of cellular respiration is oxidative phosphorylation. That's why it's called that. It happens a little bit differently, but this is also where the vast majority of the ATP that gets produced is produced, assuming that the cell is doing the whole thing, not just glycolysis. And that's what the bigger bubble here means. This, the ATP that's produced in all three places, it's indistinguishable. ATP is ATP. And it's worth the same amount of energy no matter how it's produced. This bigger yellow balloon around here simply means there's a lot more individual ATP molecules made in this third phase of cellular respiration than there are in the second phase or in glycolysis. And so this is why it is so worth it for a cell not to stop at glycolysis and have just a couple ATP produced for each glucose, but go on and finish up the job and completely spend what's left of the fuel to make a hell of a lot more ATP. It's a lot more efficient use of the fuel. Okay, now I can with a picture, define what substrate level phosphorylation is. This is how ATP is produced in glycolysis and in... Am I out of time already? Oh, no, no. I still have a half hour, right? I'm thinking of my Monday, Wednesday. Substrate level phosphorylation is how ATP gets produced in glycolysis and in the citric acid cycle, which is part of cellular respiration. And the reason it's called substrate level phosphorylation is because, well, first of all, it's phosphorylation, right? Which means adding a phosphate onto something. What is being phosphorylated? ADP gets phosphorylated to produce ATP, right? ADP has two phosphates already. You stick another one on by phosphorylating it, and you have ATP. But what makes this method substrate-level phosphorylation is that the phosphate that you're going to add to ADP is already hooked to something else, a substrate. It's not a phosphate on its own, in other words. It's a phosphate hooked to a substrate molecule, which, as all substrates do, can bind to the correct kind of enzyme, right? When the substrate that's carrying the phosphate currently binds to the enzyme, that's going to cause a transfer of the phosphate from the substrate to ADP to turn it into ATP. And the substrate gets dephosphorylated. So it's just a transfer of phosphate from a substrate to ADP to produce ATP. That's how it happens in glycolysis, and that's how it happens in the citric acid cycle. It's different for oxidative phosphorylation, but we'll talk about that when we get there. And now 11 is a summary of just glycolysis, which is only the first major part of the overall process, right? Glycolysis is part one of the complete oxidation of glucose. I told you before that there are 10 steps in glycolysis. Not all of that detail is shown here. But even though there are 10 steps, you can think of the overall glycolytic pathway, which is just another name for glycolysis, as occurring in two major phases, the so-called energy investment phase and the so-called energy payoff phase. So think about what I said the goal is. The goal is to produce ATP. But notice that in the energy investment phase, the first part of glycolysis, not only is no ATP produced, but you actually have to use ATP. So it's going exactly backwards in terms of the goal. That's why it's called the energy investment phase. You have to spend energy to make that part happen. But just like an investment of money can be worth it in the long run because it can make you more money, investing glycolysis by spending some energy in the form of ATP pays off in the long run because you end up making more ATP than you have to spend to cause the things to happen. Okay? But these numbers are all per glucose. So for each individual glucose molecule, the energy investment phase requires 2 ATPs to be spent. By spent, I mean being dephosphorylated. So 2 ATPs become 2 ADP and just 2 phosphates on their own, inorganic phosphates in solution. They're part of the phosphate pool. The energy payoff phase, though, notice, makes you 4 ATPs for each of the glucose that you started with. And that's why it's worth doing. You had to spend 2, but you get 4. And therefore, you earn a net 2 ATPs. The net is on the bottom. This is the balance sheet on the bottom. That's not the only reason it's the energy payoff phase, though. By going through the energy payoff phase, you also gain energy in the form of reduced coenzymes. Those are the taxis, right? The full taxis. You start off with empty taxis. Those are the 2 NAD pluses. And you end up with 2 NADHs and H plus. So these are carrying a lot of energy as well. The ATP is carrying a lot of energy. That's the goal. But I told you not to forget about how valuable the taxis are. Each individual NADH actually has enough energy in it to produce several ATPs eventually. So each individual NADH is even more valuable than an ATP. And you make a couple of those per glucose in the energy payoff phase of glycolysis. So here you have these inputs and outputs I was talking about input glucose, the fuel, you output pyruvate, it is partially spent fuel. You input ATP for the investment phase, but you actually end up getting more out, and a net of two, and you input oxidized coenzymes, empty taxis, NAD pluses, and you reduce them into valuable NADHs. Some cells are capable of only doing this to get energy from their fuel. So they don't, like I said before, they don't spend their fuel completely, and they only get two ATPs for every glucose. Now to 12. Here we can see the more detail of glycolysis, but this is only half of glycolysis. I told you it's 10 steps. There's only six steps shown here, or there's only half of the 10 steps, I should say five steps shown here. And I don't want you to memorize all of these intermediates. You would have to do that for a biochemistry course, but not for this course. I just want to say some important things about it. What we're looking at here, by the way, this first half is the energy investment phase. So you're starting off with glucose, of course, and what you're really doing in glycolysis in general, not just the energy investment phase, but it's splitting of sugar. That's what glycolysis means. So you start with a 6-carbon compound, you end up with 2 3-carbon compounds eventually at the end, but you do that by basically transforming one compound into the next during the pathway. Remember, a pathway is one reaction leading to another reaction and so on. So each of these is an intermediate after glucose. And right away you can see that in this first reaction step that you have to spend some energy. ATP is required to get this conversion of glucose into the second one, glucose 6-phosphate, to happen. Now, glucose 6-phosphate is named for the fact that it's glucose with a phosphate on it. So really what you're spending the energy to do here is to phosphorylate the glucose, to energize it. And therefore that leaves some ADP. Also notice that each step features its own enzyme, as we've talked about. There's no dismantling of the skeleton here yet, right? This is still a 6-carbon compound. And so is this next one. So it's really just isomerization. Each of them has the same carbons, hydrogens, and oxygen, so they're isomers of each other. It's just rearranging the atoms in preparation for eventually splitting them. Then you get down here to where the 3 is, and that's the second place where you need an ATP. All right? Now it's, and that, by the way, is why the product of that is called fructose 1,6-bisphosphate. Bis means 2. This is still a 6-carbon sugar, but now it has 2 phosphates on it. And now it can be split. So up to this point, you haven't broken anything down yet, but you're about to. When you get to this fork in the road, the reason it is a fork is because either of 2 products can be formed. But this is where the splitting takes place. Okay, so up to this point, fructose 1,6-bisphosphate, which is what you have as fuel at this moment, because the glucose has gotten turned into that, that's a 6-carbon compound. And you can break that into 2 3-carbon compounds. But there's 2 possible things that can be produced, and it's just random as to which one will actually happen. The 2 products are shown here, though, at the bottom of the left part of the slide. Dihydroxyacetone phosphate is one possibility, and glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate is the other possibility. Glyceraldehyde 3-phosphate is usually just abbreviated G3P. Okay? Like I said, you don't know which one you're going to get. You can get 1 of each, 2 of one, or 2 of the other. But you're going to get 2 total things, right? Because you're starting with a 6-carbon compound, you're breaking it into 2 3-carbon compounds. The problem with the fact that there is 2 possibilities is that only G3P, only the one possibility, is able then to go on to the rest of glycolysis. That's why it's the only one with a down arrow below it to go to the next slide, which is the rest of glycolysis. In other words, dihydroxyacetone phosphate can't go on, and it would be a dead end. It's not, though. It's not really a problem, because if it's dihydroxyacetone phosphate that's produced instead of glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate, you can just switch dihydroxyacetone phosphate around to make it into glyceraldehyde-3-phosphate. That's what these side arrows are. And that, of course, is another isomerization. It's producing another isomer out of one. And that's why the enzyme involved is called isomerase. This is an example of an enzyme that whose name is for what it is, for what it does, like dehydrogenase is. Okay, so yes, you do make some dihydroxyacetone phosphate, but it all eventually gets converted into G3P. And therefore, for each individual glucose that you started with, at this point you have two glyceraldehyde-3-phosphates. All right? That goes on to the next phase then, which is shown in slide 13. This is the energy payoff phase. It's important to keep in mind what I just told you, though. You have now two G3Ps, not just one, because the glucose had six carbons, G3P has three. Therefore, you have two for each of the glucoses you started with, and that's why all of these things are multiplied by two. It's not that you're taking two NADs here, two NAD pluses, and for each reaction. It's just that it's happening twice. It's happening once for each of the two G3Ps. So this is part of the energy payoff. An NAD plus comes in and gets reduced into NADH and H plus. That's valuable stuff. That's dehydrogenation of the fuel. Two ADPs, one for each of the two intermediates, gets phosphorylated into ATP by substrate-level phosphorylation. That's another part of the energy payoff phase. Then you have rearrangement again for a couple steps, and then finally another ATP step, ATP-producing step. Substrate-level phosphorylation of ADP into ATP. And that will leave you finally, at the end of glycolysis, with pyruvate. Glycolysis is done, but as I said, pyruvate still has valuable stuff in it. It still has carbon-hydrogen bonds. It still has a carbon skeleton. So you haven't completely spent the fuel because you haven't picked off all the hydrogens and you haven't dismantled that carbon skeleton. And that's why those two ATPs that you've gotten is only part of what you can get if you complete the process overall, which is to send pyruvate to the next part, and that is cellular respiration. But at this point, let's think about where the energy is, the usable energy. Now, the second law of thermodynamics says that every one of these steps involves some loss, is heat, right? There's nothing we can do about that. So some of the original energy of glucose is lost just as heat, unusable. Some of it is in the form of pyruvate, because that's still valuable fuel. Some of it is in the form of the ATP that's already been produced. But most of it, actually, pyruvate is a big chunk. Another big piece of it, though, of the energy, or a big fraction of the energy, is in the form of reduced coenzymes. They've picked up at this point. They're passengers. They haven't dropped them off yet. And as we'll see, they drop them off at a part of cellular respiration. That's why they're picking them up now. So that's just keep in mind that's very much energy. Can eventually produce a lot more ATP. All right, that's glycolysis. Now we can look at the particulars of cellular respiration, starting with 14. And 14 shows you the first part of cellular respiration, which I already told you is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. Well, it's called oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate because it's a redox reaction. Something gets oxidated, something gets reduced. It's called decarboxylation of pyruvate because pyruvate gets decarboxylated, which means removed of a carboxyl group. Just like dehydrogenation is removal of hydrogen, decarboxylation is removal of a carboxyl. Keep in mind your functional groups. Carboxyl is one of them, right? Well, here we have pyruvate. That's the product of glycolysis, still very valuable in terms of energy. But notice that just this part of pyruvate, the carbon here and the two oxygens, are highlighted in gray because they make up a carboxyl group. Now, you might be thinking that's not a carboxyl group because it's supposed to have an OH here, not just an O. It's true that a carboxyl has an OH, but at physiological pHs, the OH actually loses a proton easily to solution. So the H is there, it's just as a proton on its own in solution. This is a carboxyl group, though. All right? And the reason it's highlighted is to explain that one thing that happens to the pyruvate is that it gets decarboxylated. And that happens as pyruvate gets imported into the mitochondrion. That's part of this first step, because this first step is the first step of cellular respiration, after all, and cellular respiration occurs in a mitochondria, not out in the cytosol. You can see the two membranes that make up the mitochondrion here in this light orange. The dark orange is the intermembrane space. So it not only goes into the through the outer membrane, pyruvate, but it goes through the inner membrane as well. The yellow background, the biggest background here, that is the mitochondrial matrix. Remember, there's the intermembrane space, that's one compartment, and there's the matrix, that's the main compartment, fully inside the inner membrane. Okay, now, the decarboxylation, meaning removal of this gray part from pyruvate, is why you have CO2 produced. When this carboxyl group comes off by itself, it becomes a carbon dioxide molecule, carbon and two oxygens. And carbon dioxide, you need to always think of as completely spent fuel. Notice that it doesn't have a carbon skeleton. It's just one carbon now, not multiple carbons. It's been dismantled. And it doesn't have any hydrogens on it to pick off anymore. So it's worthless to us in terms of energy. And also notice that it's no longer organic. The fuel is organic. Carbon dioxide is not organic. So this is some of the CO2 that you end up exhaling because your cells are continuously doing this. But like I said, that carbon dioxide that you exhale comes from the food you ate originally. Okay, that is done. CO2's not going to be used for anything. But that leaves the two pink carbons, which are still forming a carbon skeleton, and notice there's still hydrogens attached. So you still have fuel left even after you decarboxylate pyruvate. And that's a two-carbon compound called acetyl. Don't worry about this part. Just if you had these two pink ones by themselves, that would be called acetyl. It's still valuable fuel. Not as valuable as the steps along the way, but it's not yet worthless. All right? And getting the pyruvate to acetyl involves not only decarboxylation, but it involves a redox reaction that allows for NAD plus, another empty taxi, to be reduced into NADH and H plus. That is the energy payoff of just this first step of cellular respiration. Notice that there is no ATP being produced here, which is the overall goal. But there is an energy-carrying molecule being produced, which is NADH and H+. It's just as valuable as any other NADH and H+ that's been produced earlier. but it's carrying its passengers to a later part of cellular respiration, just like the others are. In terms of the fuel that you have left, though, it's just acetyl at this point. And acetyl needs to be delivered to the next part of the process. In other words, to step two, or part two, of cellular respiration. It needs help getting delivered. So it gets picked up by another taxi-like thing, another coenzyme, which is what COA means. CO means coenzyme. A is the name of this. It's called coenzyme A. If it were by itself, just the brown thing, that would be called coenzyme A, an empty taxi. Coenzyme A is able to temporarily bind to acetyl, which is the leftover fuel after pyruvate's been decarboxylated, and drive it to the next part of the process, and then drop it off. So once again, coenzymes do this general job of picking things up and dropping them off. All right? What did I say the next part of the process is? In other words, what does coenzyme A deliver acetyl to?
The Krebs cycle.
Exactly. Citric acid cycle, Krebs cycle, tricarboxylic acid cycle, all the same thing. That's the next step, and that's where the fuel that remains, which is the acetyl, gets delivered. This phrase, acetyl coenzyme A, that refers to the whole thing, the full taxi. The taxi itself is just coenzyme A, the fuel is just acetyl, but the full taxi overall is acetyl coenzyme A. Now to 15. There's a little bit of review in 15 because we're not looking at just the citric acid cycle here. We're looking at parts 1 and 2 of cellular respiration. On the top part here, we have another version of what we just looked at. This is the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate on the top. And not all of the atoms are shown here, just the carbons are shown for ease as gray balls. Right? So the three-carbon compound is pyruvate. That's what we start with for cellular respiration, but that's what we end with from glycolysis. One of those carbons and two oxygens with it get stripped off. That becomes CO2. That's the decarboxylation part. NAD plus gets reduced in NADH and HD. That's the, NH plus. That's the oxidative part of the word. And that leaves only acetyl as the fuel, which gets picked up by coenzyme A to make acetyl coenzyme A and driven to the citric acid cycle, then coenzyme A just drops it off. So coenzyme A does not enter the citric acid cycle, only the acetyl group does, the passenger, and then coenzyme A is free to go back and pick the next passenger up and keep doing that, shuttling in more and more acetyl to the citric acid cycle. The details of the citric acid cycle aren't shown here. Well, not all of the details, but we see some important things. For one thing, it's a cycle. A cycle is still a biochemical pathway, just like any other biochemical pathway, meaning it's multiple reactions hooked end to end. But what makes it a cycle is that it wraps back on itself. So the final step feeds another initial step for another round. In terms of overall function, the citric acid cycle completes the oxidation of the fuel. Right? We've already produced some CO2 in the previous step, and that's completely oxidized, completely spent fuel already. But we still had some fuel left over, the acetyl. Citric acid cycle completely oxidizes it, so that by the time you're at the end of the citric acid cycle, the only thing you have left of what started originally as glucose are 6 carbon dioxides. 2 of them came from the 2 pyruvates. Remember, you have to multiply everything by 2. So there's 2 CO2s here because you get 1 from each of the 2 pyruvates. So that's 2 of them. The citric acid cycle produces two more for each of the acetyls. The acetyl, remember, is a two-carbon compound. You break it apart and you have two CO2s. But you have two acetyls coming in, so you end up with four more CO2s. Does that make sense? Four here and two here make six. When you look at that summary reaction, that's what the glucose turns into. Six carbon dioxides. Just like I was telling you, in general, happens when you have an organic fuel that you react with oxygen. In other words, that you combust. Whether it's methane or glucose or any other organic fuel, the product is carbon dioxide and water. Well, this is where the carbon dioxide comes from. Parts one and two of cellular respiration. Since the citric acid cycle completes the oxidation of the fuel, and by that I mean it completes the dehydrogenation and it completes the dismantling, you have nothing left of any more of fuel at the end of the citric acid cycle. So you might say, why is there anything left after the citric acid cycle? Well, that's because we still haven't made as much ATP as we can. The fuel is gone, but there's still usable energy from it. Before we get to that, though, notice that more ATP gets produced in this part of the overall process. We made a little bit in glycolysis by substrate level phosphorylation earlier. Now we make a little bit more ATP also by substrate level phosphorylation in the citric acid cycle. But when you add this ATP and the ATP from glycolysis together, you still have only a little bit of energy in the form of ATP. And I just told you that there's no more fuel left. So where does all the extra ATP in the final step come from? Well, it comes from finally using the energy that is being carried by the coenzyme taxis. And we've already made some NADH and H+ in two different places already, right? In glycolysis and in the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate. The citric acid cycle makes even more NADH and H+. Plus it makes the second version of a coenzyme. I told you there were multiple versions. It turns FAD into FADH2. That's like a competing company. It's still a taxi, but it's a different version. It's doing the same job, but instead of it being nicotinamide adenine dinucleotide, this is flavin adenine dinucleotide, because flavin is the particular nitrogenous base that is able to be oxidized and reduced in that coenzyme. Let's take a couple seconds to compare that to NAD plus and NADH plus, the oxidized and reduced forms of NAD. It's a little bit different here. Notice that the oxidized form for flavin adenine dinucleotide is just FAD, not FAD plus. You still, though, can take two hydrogens off of the fuel, which is two electrons and two protons. Well, if you take one of the electrons and one of the protons, that's a hydrogen, and you still have one electron and one proton. So this can take all four passengers. And therefore, the reduced form is not FADH, and you don't have any leftover H+, it's FADH2. That's the reduced form. It's carrying a lot of energy as well, just like NADH and H+ is. So, back to what I was saying about the fuel being gone, that's true. There's no more fuel left, nothing that can be extracted from any of those six carbon dioxides. You've only made a little bit of ATP, though. You've lost some energy as heat. Nothing you can do about it. But at this point, all of the usable energy is in the form... I mean, all of the usable energy that's not already made into ATP is in the forms of these reduced coenzymes. NADH from glycolysis, NADH from the oxidative decarboxylation of pyruvate, NADH from the citric acid cycle itself, and FADH2 from the citric acid cycle. All of those are now full taxis carrying a lot of energy combined, and they're all going to be driving to the same destination, which is the third part of cellular respiration. That's where the final payoff is in terms of making even more ATP and a lot of it. So now I'm out of time, right? Okay.